I'm Rhea Turtle-Talbies. Good afternoon. I'm Rhea Turtle-Taub, UCLA's Vice Chancellor for External Affairs, and I have the privilege of welcoming you all today to UCLA's first ever virtual town hall for volunteer leaders spanning the entire university. Thanks for making time to join us this afternoon. Your partnership and your support allows UCLA to expand its reach throughout our community and indeed around the globe. And we very much appreciate your desire to be the best advocates and leaders by learning more about UCLA's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. A few quick formatting notes before we dive in. In the interest of time, we're going to forego formal introductions. I believe you know most, if not all, of our participants today. And for anyone whose background you'd like more information on, I invite you to go online to learn more. Like everything else in our lives today, we're going to find everything online. We're going to move quickly from speaker to speaker, holding your very good questions. Thank you for submitting them in advance. Holding those till the end, with one exception. To accommodate Dr. Mazziota's schedule, he'll field a couple of questions after his remarks and then depart. And then we'll continue with our program and returning to questions for our remaining panelists after that. So why don't we get started? I'd like to kick us off by inviting our chancellor to deliver his remarks about where we are from an overarching standpoint about UCLA's response to the pandemic. Thank you, Chancellor.
Thank you, Rhea, and good afternoon, everyone. And hope you're well, and I hope you're safe. And it's only to acknowledge the extraordinary situation we find ourselves in, and we recognize all of us are dealing with enormous challenges, and our students certainly are struggling with uncertainty, with anxiety, as is everyone in our family. So we certainly acknowledge this is a very challenging time for everyone. So in this challenging time, we're trying to maintain a great university at its level of greatness that we all expect. And we all know that universities have very long lives and have long time constants. And this university will be here for a very long time. And we have to just make certain that we can get through this crisis with as little damage as possible, and hopefully learning a good deal along the way. So our lives have changed. You know, I now work from the residence. I've been isolating myself in place now for about 4 weeks, but connected electronically. And we have busy days. I mean, I think everyone at the university is staying extremely busy, both faculty and administrators. You know, we start off with regular meetings every morning, vice chancellors and chancellor meetings on campus, but also with the Office of the President and other campuses, which have been very useful to learn from each other. So those have been helpful, but that really fills the morning really with meetings, as well as other contacts that go out throughout the day. So life continues and business continues at the university. You know, we've moved obviously to remote education, remote communication, and that has been challenging. And I have to say it's been challenging for our students and challenging for our faculty. Everyone varies in their facility in using this new technology, and some faculty are truly pros and have been doing this for a while. But for most people, most of us, it's new, and there's a learning curve. But what I'm hearing, and I'm teaching a small seminar, so I'm getting some direct responses from the students in my seminar, is that students and faculty are adapting to this new world and adapting in many cases quite effectively, not without glitches, but quite effectively, and new methods of teaching are really developing. There's a lot of creativity going on in the new electronic classroom. Things we're going to learn that will be very valuable. So I'm really overjoyed that everyone has taken this challenge with the right compassion and understanding that it's going to be a challenging time. You know, looking forward for the university, there are challenges ahead. There's no doubt we're still very uncertain about the summer. I mean, you only have to read the newspaper to recognize that, you know, the crisis is not going to abate quickly. And there are time delays involved in developing appropriate, you know, widespread testing, as well as getting the economy back to some reasonable fashion. So we're going to have to expect a disrupted summer and fall, frankly. We're looking about, you know, what fall could look like, and we're developing a number of scenarios. There's a lot of planning going on in campus, and we have to imagine everything from, you know, online education, much as we're doing now, to sort of a hybrid where students are back, but perhaps not participating in large classes. There's lots of different ways to, you know, re-engage. And, but we do recognize it's going to be, there's going to be a delay certainly before all that occurs. We're also concerned, quite frankly, financially about the future. That's not something that's at the top of our mind right now. Right now we have to get through this crisis, but there are long-lasting impacts. We know that the economy of the state certainly will be impacted by the current pandemic, and that will affect future revenues, which will certainly have an effect on our budget and the budget of many other institutions that rely on state support. So we expect changes in funding in the future. Our students' families are being impacted. The number of people out of work is astounding and concerning. And those are our parents. Many of those are the parents of our students, and they'll also be challenged to return to life as normal, given that their financial situation may change over time. We have to be considering that. So it's a, you know, it is a changed world. I have great confidence there's an endpoint, you know, and why do I have confidence? Because places like UCLA, there's great research going on, and that research will solve these problems. There is solutions to flu and virus, other viruses. Pandemics can be addressed through research and through, you know, proper studies, and we and other institutions really throughout the world, this isn't just a US effort, this is a global effort, to find vaccines and to find antivirals. So I'm confident there's an endpoint. It's just that right now we're more at the beginning than the end. So we just have to keep the faith that our researchers, our scientists will be successful. I also want to really provide an enormous amount of gratitude for our health system. So, you know, half of UCLA in terms of number of personnel, in terms of budgets, is really our health system. It's an extraordinary system, as you know, that reaches throughout California, Southern California, and beyond in many ways. And the people in this system have just been heroic. As we all know, we've been watching the news, they take risks every day just by going into the hospital. They're dedicated, they're professional, they're working extremely hard, they're saving lives, and they've really transformed the hospital in preparation for this, for the challenges of the pandemic. So, you know, my hat goes off to everyone involved in that, from the top, from John Mazzioto, our obviously our Vice Chancellor for Health Affairs, all the way down through to everyone working in the hospital. I really do appreciate it. So with that, perhaps maybe I'll turn this over to, if Dr. Mazzioto has joined us, I'm going to turn this over now to Vice Chancellor Mazzioto so he can give us some insights about what's happening in the health system. John?
Thanks, Gene. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. Obviously, the outbreak of COVID-19 is an evolving and unprecedented global crisis, and it's one that we have planned for and have worked intensely on since mid-February. Our top priorities, as always, are the care and safety of our patients, the care and safety of our healthcare workers, and the care and safety of the communities that we serve. Obviously, this is a key moment in world history and also in the history of the medical profession. The citizens of our communities are counting on us, and this is our mission, this is our responsibility, and we will succeed in this challenge. And I have to say, I've been just unbelievably inspired by my colleagues and the leadership who work with me, their dedication, their commitment, their professionalism, their courage, not only planning, but now facing the actual care of many patients with this disorder. Let me just give you a status update of what we do. So we run these kinds of events, earthquakes, fires, mass casualties, in a military fashion. We set up a command center. There's a strict hierarchy. Everyone has a job. We plan that way. We execute that way. We flex the amount of space we have depending on the circumstances. And we've been at this, as I said, for 7 weeks around the clock. You've all seen the international and national numbers about deaths and positive cases. I won't talk about that. I'll just focus on what I follow as often as possible, which is the LA County numbers. Currently, there are 7,500 patients who have tested positive in LA County, with 198 deaths as of yesterday afternoon. At UCLA Health and our hospitals, we have slowly ticked picked up a few patients every day, starting in late February, and now we currently have 40 patients in our hospitals, of which 16 are in ICUs and 14 are intubated. We've had a very low fatality rate, I think in part because we weren't overwhelmed like New York, and meticulous care and attention to every detail with every patient has been possible. That said, we have had a significant number of healthcare workers who have tested positive, more than half probably in the community, but they're absent from our workforce. Other things that have happened that have been unprecedented is we had to create our own test. So we weren't able to get tests from the outside. So back in February, we started to build with the machines we have for research and other purposes, our own test to identify the virus in swabs from the nose and throat. And we're now up to doing almost 1,000 tests a day with a turnaround time of about 4 to 5 hours. We hope to bring that to about 2,000 tests a day by next week. We've completed just under 6,000 tests, and we've helped support other testing for other organizations to the abilities that we have in terms of capacity. So other hospitals, nursing homes, the VA, the county hospitals, as best we could, and hopefully we'll be able to do more of that. We're moving to testing every patient who comes in to be admitted to the hospital or needs a procedure. We've drastically reduced the census of our hospitals. So they normally run at 100 to 105% today. The Reagan Hospital in Westwood is at 60% and Santa Monica Hospital at 45%. Because we anticipate a surge of patients, and we have to have space and capacity to do that. We will also, if necessary, reduce the use other spaces that we commonly use for procedures or post-operative recovery. We'll use those as patient care spaces. The ingenuity of the faculty and the students has been impressive. They've created the test. We're now creating our own face shields. We have to rebuild our entire supply chain because the supply chain we count on has not functioned and not been able to scale up to the numbers we need for personal protective equipment. I've been incredibly impressed by the commitment of our corporate CEO friends, our philanthropists, our donors who have provided everything from money to food to commitments of every kind, and that's really allowed us to do some of the things that other hospitals would never be able to do, create a separate supply chain from Asia and fund a lot of these issues. We've tried to do a lot of things for our workers, free food in the cafeteria, groceries that they can buy here rather than have to wait in line, free food deliveries for them at their homes, and many other things. The campus has been great, and I want to thank the chancellor for providing hotel space for our healthcare workers who couldn't or wouldn't be able to go home at night, and dormitories potentially for patients who are discharged from the hospital but cannot go home for various reasons. The financial impact of this is profound. We anticipate we'll be losing $140 million a month in the healthcare system. And we will have to count on federal and state assistance to get through that. So that's a brief snapshot of where things stand. We are ready, we're poised, we have space, we have the talent, and we're confident that we can manage this crisis successfully and with the kind of care and attention to detail that we try to deliver every day, every night, and every weekend.
Thank you, Dr. Mazzotta. I wanted to just toss you a question or two before you have to go. Our listeners were very, very good about addressing questions in advance. And one of those questions has to do with when a blood test might be available. People are concerned about vaccines as well as blood tests in advance. So anything you can share in that regard?
So a blood test is not of any use in this phase of the pandemic. A blood test tells you whether you have antibodies after being exposed to the virus that are then protecting you and immunizing you. In this phase of the pandemic, we need to detect the virus itself. So those tests are not blood tests, they're nasal swabs where we detect the RNA within the virus and determine whether the patient is infected. We are testing in our laboratories the blood tests for these antibodies, and that will be very helpful to see who is immunized, who could come back to work. More importantly, they will identify people who have antibodies that we could collect by taking the serum of their blood and then infusing that into patients who are acutely ill and giving them immunity as if they had been vaccinated. So that may be an important therapeutic tool that we can use on the sickest patients in an experimental way. It was done in China. They've only reported on a handful of patients, but the results looked good. On a vaccine, that'll be a collaboration between academic health centers like UCLA and all the others in the country and the pharmaceutical industry, because identifying the basic science to build a vaccine will come from all those entities, but the actual production of a vaccine in the tens of or hundreds of millions or billions of doses will require an army of pharmaceutical companies to do it. And I think that's quite a ways off, probably not something we can count on for the fall when we anticipate another round of this to occur.
Thank you. And this last question for you may be a little too soon to answer entirely, but it was posed, what top two or three lessons have been learned by the medical profession at this point, whether in terms of anticipation or how we're going to go through this? Any thoughts at this juncture?
Yeah, not too soon. So number one, learn from those who have been through it first. So we had a two-hour call the other night with our colleagues in China. We have a sister medical school in Zhejiang outside of Shanghai, and they sent 40 physicians to Wuhan. And we asked them every question we could think of, and we learned a lot from that. The primary thing we learned was that the best way to stop this is not in a hospital, but in society with the governor and the mayor and the things you now have learned all too well. That's what puts this to an end. And also really quarantining people who are infected in their close contacts. In China, they did that not on an honor system, go home and stay in your room, but people were put in central government-run facilities with guards. The second thing I would say is in a pandemic, you can't count on anyone else. When we have a fire, you know, firefighters come from Montana and Alaska, and that's not what we have here. Everyone's in the same situation at once. So you have to be able to fend for yourself. Fortunately, we practice and train and have reserves to manage something not quite the size, but in general, big items like earthquakes and fires. And I guess the third thing is that you have to use every resource. So we have medical students putting together face shields that were printed in libraries in the engineering school and doing injection molds. We have people like me who know nothing about supply chain calling CEOs all over the world to put together air freight and other ways to get the materials that we need here and through customs. We've had scientists stop everything that they're doing and shift all their work to the problem at hand. And it's very impressive how people can just do that and stop what they're doing and just get on board and get focused and get it done. It's been amazing.
So we'll let you jump. And just want to thank you again for making the time for all the people who are listening. We're incredibly appreciative and incredibly grateful to you and all of your colleagues who are doing so much at this point. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to particularly thank the Dean of the Medical School, Kelsey Martin, and the President of UCLA, Hal, Jenny Spizo. They have been amazing, calm, confident, and totally on point. Thanks again.
Thank you. All right. Pat, would you like to share the undergraduate experience?
Well, I want to start by giving a shout out to Dr. Mazziota and everything that our colleagues in the healthcare system are doing. I'm so proud that my business card says UCLA on it at this time because of the range of colleagues that I have across the campus. I spent 2 nights in Santa Monica and 6 nights in Ronald Reagan last year. And everyone from the housekeeping staff, the people who bring you the food, of course, the doctors, they're all rock stars. The most satisfying for me as Dean and Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education, of course, were when the student nursing students were tagging along with the nurses and students observing. And of course, that's where my focus is right now on our undergraduate population who are taking their courses in the same way that we're getting this meeting right now. I've got a small class, 20 students, and includes one student who's taking the class from China at 6 a.m, another student who's taking it from Brazil at 6 in the evening. And it's supposed to be an intimate seminar situation, not the stuff of technology. And I checked in with the director of our Center for the Advancement of Teaching. She's teaching a large engineering course. And we're both having the same experience with the students. They are, the way she put it is, it's like they're rooting for us to succeed. They know that we did not grow up ever imagining ourselves talking into a computer screen in order to make a diagram or to draw a point. But they're giving us the same eye contact. They're giving us the feedback in the chats. I asked all of my students last week to email me after class, and they'd all done so within about 90 minutes. And the remark I'll remember from one of them who, you know, we'd gone over the syllabus like you always do in the first class of a session, we'd gone over the syllabus, and she said, "I am going to be looking forward to this class every week for the whole quarter." And it doesn't really get any better than that. That's the approach that our students are taking to this unprecedented situation that we're finding ourselves in. I think it's important to remember that, and Rhea, you can correct me on this because I think you are the parent of a freshman, but if you're the parent of a freshman, that student was born in the year 2000, right around the year 2000?
2001, yep.
Yep, 2001, so think about that. Think about being born in the year 2001. A senior's been born about 1998. They didn't even go through Y2K. Hurricane Katrina was something they read about in books. For most of their lives, the president of the United States was Barack Obama. That's the experience, that's the foundation that they're entering into this situation where they're insecure about the way we're gonna grade them. They don't know what's going to happen to their resumes if they don't get internships, if they don't get the community service work that they'd counted on. They don't know think about what your thoughts on the job market are if you're expecting to get your diploma this June. How on earth you begin to apply for jobs for graduate school and so forth in this environment. So I think what I would ask of the folks on the call, because you did tell us we could do an ask, and my ask is around a loyalty to the classes of 2020, 21, 22. We're going to need it for a while, 23. If we end up starting remotely this fall, if a freshman class starts its experience of UCLA online, you know, this is going to shape them as well as it's shaping our seniors right now. So they're going to need that Bruin connection throughout the region, throughout California, throughout the country, throughout the world as a safety net against the situation that they're facing themselves in, where before this, they knew what to do, what internship to get, how to apply for jobs, how to network. But this has taken all of those traditional modalities off the table for them and just given them this one. So they're going to need the rest of the Bruin family to support them in the years ahead. And I'm confident that they're going to get that from our group. So I think that at this juncture, I'll turn this over to my partner in crime on things related to students and introduce Vice Chancellor Monroe Gordon.
Thank you, Pat. I want to thank Rhea for setting this up and then for the Chancellor as well for providing the opportunity for us to be able to speak to a large group of individuals and also provide my thanks to the myriad of individuals who are working both on and off campus to continue to look after the health and safety of our community. And so certainly our healthcare workers, and then individuals such as our janitors and other folks who are coming through facilities to campus every single day and really putting their own jeopardy and health on the line at times to make sure that the rest of the community is doing well. So I want to thank them. So for everyone, my name is Monroe Gordon. Again, I'm the Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, which means I have the pleasure of providing service to over 46,000 students at UCLA. So both the undergraduates and the graduate students all enjoy services through Student Affairs. We have about 800 professional staff and employ somewhere in the area of 4,200 undergraduate students. And so we actually have a very, very large percentage, if not the largest percentage, of undergraduate students working within Student Affairs. And I think that's a very apt thing to have, considering the kind of support that we provide. If I can maybe leave you with anything as I continue to talk about what we're doing on campus, it's to make sure that people understand that there are services available for our students. And while we have been, I think, mindful of what it means to go through safe distancing, to ensure that we are being compliant with what both the governor as well as the mayor has advocated about safer at home and sheltering in place, it is important though for students in particular to know that there are services available across the board within Student Affairs. And so, as Pat said earlier, different modalities, different ways to experience it, but we also want to make sure that they understand those services exist. And there are quite a few individuals who are working to try to make this the best overall experience in this unprecedented time for our students. So let me just give you a little bit of information about some of the services that are open. So we actually have our ASH Health and Wellness Center, which provides student health support to all of our students, both undergraduate and graduates. And so I have a number of healthcare workers in ASH who continue to come in into the job every day. They're doing testing on students. They are there to provide support to our students. And so that's certainly one of the areas that is open both on campus as well as through telehealth opportunities. The other is our residential life area. And so these are the individuals who provide support for and development for students who are living on campus and off campus. And it's important also to recognize that we actually have about 8% of our students who typically live on campus who are still there. So we have about 900 or so students who remain on campus. And so we actually have a great responsibility to ensure that we're providing those students the level of support that's necessary for them to be successful both in and out of the classroom. Some of the issues that we're facing or that we have faced as an organization with our students, making sure that we're hyper-focused on providing for the basic needs of our students. One thing that you've heard over and over again is that this is an unprecedented time, and there are a lot of people who are struggling and greatly in pain, both physiologically and also from what's happening from a financial standpoint. Our students are no different. Right, and so we have a number of students who have lost jobs off campus in particular, who are struggling to pay rent, who are struggling to be able to buy food, who are helping support family members. So there are very serious issues and concerns that we want to make sure as a campus that we are trying to help contribute to a solution toward. And that means that we've got to maintain a hyper focus on providing for the basic needs of our students. We do that primarily through two different mechanisms. One is through our economic crisis response team, and that's a team that was set up prior to what's happening today. But that team in place provides for any student that is going through an economic crisis. And what we try to do with that team is not just provide the funding, but also provide the wraparound service that tries to look at how do we ensure that the student, as much as we can, doesn't end up in the situation going forward. The other service on campus that tries to help provide for basic needs is literally through what we call our Basic Needs Committee. And these are individuals who cut across all disciplines at UCLA, coordinated through our Community Programs Office, that provides a litany of services and products for our students, hopefully to assist in their basic needs. It also includes what we called previously the food closet. But as you can imagine, because we don't have a number of people on campus, we've actually moved to providing gift cards to individuals who are in need of food or in have food insecurity. So those are only two of the services that we're providing for this particular issue. If I can give one call to action, and that was one of the things that I think we were requested to do, what I would say is, I think on campus, we've been very good at thinking about how we describe what I'm going to call safe distancing, what I think we often hear on the news is being called social distancing. And the reason I call it safe distancing is sometimes when we use the term social distancing, it allows individuals who may not be as close to us or to the friends that we have to think that it's okay to malign individuals because of ethnicity or because of where they're from geographically. And so my one call to action is that we are very, very mindful that during this time where all of us are hurting in many ways and all of us find ourselves in precarious and challenging and unprecedented situations, that it doesn't stop us though from really caring about each other as Bruins and caring about how we feel as community members. We want to ensure that these situations do not allow for any type of xenophobic, racist, or any kind of offensive types of actions to take place. And unfortunately, we have seen around the world from some individuals of Asian descent in particular, where they have been maligned or they have been attacked and they have been targeted. And so my one call to action is to ensure that in our Bruin community, where we fight so hard for the wonderful diversity that we have and the wonderful respect that we provide everyone, that we continue to do so and that we continue to support each other.
Thank you, Monroe. Very important message, your last one in particular. I really, really appreciate you saying that. The anxiety does run high in lots of places, and the more we can behave as family for one another, the better off we will all be. In that vein, I want to go back to something that Vice Provost and Dean Pat Turner said about the importance of thinking how our soon-to-be minted graduates are feeling, our young alumni, and in fact, even our well-established alumni. Careers are being disrupted every day, and UCLA, through our Alumni Association, has a wonderful platform that I hope everyone will take an opportunity to look at. It's called UCLA One. If you simply go to alumni.ucla.edu, you will find it. But it is the place where we provide opportunities to link with students and fellow alumni, being able to provide opportunities for mentorship and just practicing at informational interviewing, peer-to-peer or learning about different careers and peer-to-peer conversation. That is such an important way in which our volunteer leaders can dive in and help at this very crucial moment, because I will say I personally have a member of the class of 2020 at another university, but I know what the senior class is experiencing, and it is quite challenging. And but this is so true that it's not just the class of 2020, but it'll be all those young alumni who were hired last, and they find themselves in precarious situations. But if we link arms and represent our very best of Bruin values at this moment in time especially, I think that we can do a lot for members of our family. I wanted to get back to some of the questions that others have asked, and thank you for those good questions. And they center, just so folks know, around remote learning, around admissions, graduation. Chancellor, you referenced financial impact to the university. And I thought you might say just a little bit more about the kinds of things we have to look at to understand the ramifications of the situation we're in.
Thank you. Yes, we are beginning to try to get our head around exactly what the costs are of the current crisis. And we're doing this in part because the Office of the President, at the request of the Regents, is trying to get a better feeling for university resources overall, liquidity of the various campuses. So we're trying to give them an estimate, but of course we're working on an estimate for our own use. And it's challenging, you know, the financial situation. As you can imagine, you know, many dorm contracts were canceled, housing contracts, because the students have gone home, as they should be. But that has led to a significant reduction in revenues. And yet at the current time, our workforce is still intact. And the expenses remain about the same for us, but the revenues have gone down significantly. So that's certainly a component. The summer is going to be altered, and we know that there's going to be significant losses this summer. That's for certain. The fall we're uncertain about. You know, we do worry about whether the athletic seasons will occur as projected, and of course there's a risk there as well with income from athletics. Clearly, the conference center and all of our activities that occur on campus surrounding those areas will be impacted. So, and of course, the major driver here will be the hospital, whose revenues have been severely impacted because the hospital census has gone down quite dramatically to accommodate, to provide enough beds when there's urgently sick people. Therefore, you know, elective surgeries and other elective procedures have been postponed. So overall, the total cost is going to be extremely high. It's going to be, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and how much more will depend on how long this goes on for. But we're prepared for taking a very large financial hit. We can survive that. You know, we have resources, but we will have to be very careful. And certainly, you know, this is something where, you know, we're going to have to be very mindful of our expenses going forward. As I said earlier in my comments, is that we don't expect the state economy to be strong for a while, and that's going to have impact on our future budget. So I think we're all facing a challenging time. I think we're approaching this the right way, that, you know, we can maintain excellence at this university. We maybe have to be trimmer in some areas. We all have to be mindful. All the deans certainly are aware of that, have to be mindful of their budgets. And we have been through challenges before financially. Certainly in the 2009 downturn, we faced an enormous challenge in the amount of state resources available to the institution. And we weathered that quite well. So, you know, I have confidence that the spirit is here. The Bruin spirit is operating. Everyone recognizes they have to share in the pain a bit here. We all want the same thing. We want students to graduate. We want them to get a great education. And we want the scholarship to continue with the university research. Very important. And we're committed to doing that.
Right. You mentioned graduation. There's been a lot of conversation about graduation. And so for those of our volunteer leaders who are listening and may not have been involved in those discussions prior, maybe you'd like to share, maybe you and Pat might share a little bit about how we're approaching graduation.
Well, I'll make the first comment because it's an apology. So in the middle of all this panic about what we were facing, we decided, you know, that we have to provide some, you know, we have to provide as much detail as we can to our students in as honest a way as we can. And we felt it would be important to let them know that there's no way we could anticipate graduation occurring in June in person as we normally would do. And this is a very big year. This is a centennial year. So we announced that we'd have to do a virtual graduation. I announced it. And that was met with much unhappiness, probably as much unhappiness as anything I've ever announced. And as quickly as I announced it, I recognized that I felt they had made a mistake, quite honestly, and mistake for a couple of reasons. One is that it was the wrong time to be announcing it because students were just struggling with the end of classes, with exams. So it was bad timing. So that was certainly something that I recognized was an error. I also felt we didn't have enough student involvement in the decision making. You know, we have a student government, a very competent student government, and they should have been more involved in the decision making. And I really failed to consult as much as I should have. So I decided when you make a mistake, you walk it back. And I apologized, and I decided
let's plan, let's bring students into the process, let's plan and see what's possible. And maybe there can be a postponed graduation, or maybe there has to be some other arrangements. But I recognize that this is such an important year. Every year is important. Graduation is important every year, but this year especially is important. And we needed some more thought. So with that, maybe I'll turn it over to Dean Turner.
Hi, yeah. So we are, and Vice Chancellor Gordon and Associate Vice Chancellor Julie Sine and I have put together a group of faculty, staff, and importantly students to strategize about many things about sustaining community during the spring quarter for our students. And commencement's a big part of that. We're going to be rolling out a survey to the students probably Friday on their portal that's called MyUCLA, with a lot of questions about what they want. What we're hearing from them so far is they do want to mark something this June. This is what they've been looking forward to, right? June 2020, since they were freshmen. We give them tassels when they come in as freshmen. So they want to do something this June. They're a little bit, they're understandably unenthusiastic about having everything in a virtual ceremony. That doesn't seem right. So we're thinking about doing something that launches their commencement. We'll do something to recognize them in June, and then they want the opportunity to come back when it's safe to gather in large groups. That may be December, it may not be till next June. They don't really care what it is, but they want us to say when it is safe for everyone to come back to campus, let's do that. And that'll be the closure point ceremoniously. And that's what we're leaning towards, something that launches commencement season appropriately this June, but that's not the end of their commencement experience at UCLA.
Thanks, Pat. Chancellor, you both referenced the fall. And a number of people have asked the questions along the lines of what are the sorts of considerations that go into decision-making about the fall? Obviously, there's a lot we don't know yet, but can you just share what things will be weighing in those decision-making moments?
Yeah, so for me, primarily, it's safety. We are learning a lot about remote education. We think it has some great attributes. We also see its limitations. And we believe that students that are not here, that are not present, are losing out on extraordinary opportunities. As we know, beyond the classroom, there's all the student groups and activities on campus that are all part of the learning experience. So we're highly motivated to get students back. The problematic issue will be that by doing what we're doing now, which is absolutely required, which is flattening the curve in terms of the number of people that are contracting coronavirus, the problem is, of course, that it does extend out the amount of people that will be susceptible, that's a good thing in the sense our health system can handle people in a way and minimize loss of life. But it does mean that there's going to be a lot of students who probably still are susceptible. And the question is, can you bring them back into an environment unless you can test very effectively and even possibly have a serological test for antibodies to know who's been exposed and who could be safe? So the main consideration is how can we safely bring students back to campus? And a little bit of that will depend on what's available in terms of testing. So with appropriate testing, I think we could devise a methodology to bring students back safely. That's our desire, to have as normal a fall quarter as we can. But I think we're gonna have to be listening to experts on this. This is one where data is gonna be important. And I don't think any one of us are gonna recommend having a regular fall quarter if we can't bring students back safely.
Thank you. Just to follow up on what a regular quarter is or isn't, you're teaching a class this quarter, your leadership, Fiat Lux class. Can you share a little bit about, you had two sessions at this point by now, or is that,
yeah. The second session's this afternoon for me. And Dean Turner's also teaching one of these, and so I think we're both getting
experience.
And I have a student, actually, I also have a student from Australia from Sydney who's participating. So it's kind of fun. It feels quite special to have, you know, sort of an international class. But we have the class is actually on COVID-19, and it's bringing in experts to talk both about the disease, but also about the university's response to it, and to help better inform students about, you know, how the decision making that goes into this. This is often obscure to students, why we decide when we ask them to leave, when we ask them back. I mean, I think this gives them an opportunity for a small group of students to better understand our decision making, you know, the good decisions and the decisions we're less satisfied with as we look back. So we're trying to have a really candid discussion. The students are great, and they're of course much more expert than we are about online techniques. So they're very comfortable operating in Zoom, and we're playing catch up, I think, but enjoying it a lot. So it's just one course, just one session so far. So I'm still just a beginner.
That's great. Just a couple more questions, and maybe Pat, you can field some of this about some of the limitations perhaps that instructors are feeling at this point. You may have addressed some of this already, but I thought maybe you could go a little bit deeper about how the university is addressing the challenges that the chancellor is just saying that our students may be further ahead than some of our faculty in terms of their remote learning techniques. But how's the university responding to that?
One of the things is we're trying to make this, you know, the phrase a teachable moment. You know, we've been moving into the hybrid and online environment for a while, and this is really giving us a crash course. So we're actually going to be doing some fairly sophisticated learning assessment of students. A group of our instructional resource people on campus are designing that right now. Some of the things we're noticing, though, for example, and I don't know if this has been your experience, Chancellor, or not, but I have students in my class who are clearly coming to it from a fairly posh background. I have no other way of saying it. And I have other students that are really in obviously cramped in a very, very different circumstance. So everybody can see that on the screen, right? You can see the student who's got very expensive appliances behind them, and you can see the student that's clearly in a different circumstance. As somebody put it, the classroom is an equalizer. If I'm in teaching a class in Moore Hall, all the students are equal, right? You don't see that background. You don't see any visible trappings of who they are. Some students are having to learn while their younger brothers and sisters are in the same space, doing K-12 work. Other students have access to privacy. The faculty, you know, we're used to, there are technologies for this, but that ability to just quickly go to the board and respond to what they're saying in real time and write, that's more laborious. It's more laborious to do that with the technology. I had thought that doing a small class would be more problematic, but it's actually when you have a class of, you know, many of our classes are over 200 students. So how do you have that? When I have 200 students in Moore Hall, I can work the room. Right, I can walk up and down the aisles. I can look over at who's actually doing something on their laptop they shouldn't be doing. You don't have that ability in this online modality, and we're actually going to be doing some assessment exercises to take the temperature of that.
Thank you. And Monroe, you spoke earlier about the resources that are available for students because of the various stresses and stressors on their lives. Could you just add a little bit more in terms of the kinds of things we're hearing? Pat alluded to some of them, but how is the campus prepared to address whether it's through the economic crisis response team or other resources that the university has? Just share a little bit more if you would about that.
Sure. Yeah, I think that you might want to break it down into a couple different buckets, right? I think that we certainly have needs where we have to provide immediate funding or support to the students, but then we have the psychological needs as well of our students. And that's one thing I didn't touch on, but we continued through telehealth and telemedicine to provide opportunities for students, not only for what I call physical health, but also for mental health. And so, Rhea, to answer your question around that part of support, which has been a very core part of the support that we provide for student development and student health, that continues for our students, despite the fact that students are not coming in person. We actually have every single one of our CAPS clinician, our counseling and psychological services clinicians, who are participating currently in a telehealth sort of model that provides services to our students. Additionally, staying with mental health for a second, we also are working with our Depression Grand Challenge individuals. So one of the grand challenges that the chancellor has established in looking at depression, these are colleagues of ours across the campus. And so we've engaged in conversation and discussion to ensure that as students are utilizing these services and recognize the services exist, that we have sufficient levels of clinical expertise to be able to provide a level of support to them. Beyond that, you know, I think the anxiety and the stressors, they extend for students throughout all corners of the activities that they have. And so as I think about the types of services that we provide, whether it's through our career services area. And so Rhea, thank you for talking about UCLA One. That's a service that we work very closely with in the Career Center. So AVC, Sina and I have worked very, very closely with that in addition to Handshake, which is the online portal for students who are registered at UCLA. That can certainly be, I think, a very large stressor for students. A number of our students are engaged, as the chancellor said, in a lot of clubs and activities. And while I think to some individuals, maybe from the outside, they see clubs and activities as just being this fun thing to do, these are very, very serious opportunities for our students to not only think about their own levels of engagement, but to also provide service and support and help to our community. So we have a lot of student-initiated programming that literally goes into the community and provides direct support and direct help to the community. And so in a situation like this, where some of our students who are engaged in that critical work are not able to do the same things that they have done, it demands that we think through alternatives and ways for them to still be able to provide for the communities that they see as being so important. So a lot of these different activities, Rhea, I think are opportunities for stress and anxiety for students who are trying to grapple with, you know, how do I now do things in this remote environment? And that's why I thought it was really important to say that if you go to a little bit of plug here, the UCLA Student Affairs website, and literally I do it all the time, just go to Google and type in UCLA Student Affairs, it'll take you to our website. We have on the front page there a graphic that shows, you know, what services are open. How do you reach these services? How do you get in instant touch with individuals who are there to support you? And the last thing I'll say, just to sort of answer your question a little bit further, Rhea, the reason I mentioned we have 800 professional staff, what I tell students every single year as I meet, whether it's graduate students or undergraduate students, is that I have been, I think, just extraordinarily fortunate to work in at UCLA, certainly, and then more specifically in student affairs, where professionals across the board are there to help students. And clearly we have professionals who are working in recreation versus student health versus the career services area, and they have different levels of expertise. But the one thread and connector is that it doesn't matter who you reach within student affairs, they're there to assist and to make sure that we're able to provide for the development of our students.
Thank you. And I would say that certainly in my 25 plus years on campus, I think those are values that extend across the university. And Chancellor, I want to thank you for your incredible leadership through this time. The rate at which you are going from meeting to meeting, Zoom call to Zoom call, so many people, the way the university has pulled together and now pulling our volunteers into this conversation about the ways in which all of us can link arms and move our family, our community, and our institution forward for the betterment of our community, the state, the nation, and the world. Our time is nearing its end, and I just want to thank everybody again who's joined us for this town hall. How much we truly appreciate the work that you do on behalf of UCLA, the support you provide in so many ways. Hopefully you've learned a bit more about how we're managing in this crisis and the ways in which you can be involved. Most importantly, if you can simply amplify the messages you've heard today when you are 6 to 10 feet apart from your from your family and your neighbors, your colleagues. I know every business is every sector is impacted by this. Everybody is dealing with how they move their organizations forward. The ideas that you are working, the creative ways in which you are working, and if you have ideas for us, we want to hear them. We are very, very eager to learn from others, and at the same time, we are hopeful that you will help share with your networks, personal and professional, that which you've heard today. If you are on our website, please familiarize yourself with our health resources. When you hear people talking about trying to find the best information, send them to the UCLA Health website. It is up to date, up to the minute, and it is an incredible resource, not only for the UCLA family, but the larger community. So in that regard, we want to count on your partnership and your advocacy today and always. It has been our pleasure to work with you over so many years, but now especially that partnership is so important. And I want to thank all of our speakers today, Vice Provost and Dean Pat Turner, Vice Chancellor Monroe Gordon, Dr. Mazziota, and certainly Chancellor Block. Thank you so much for being a part of this, and we really appreciate all of you tuning in. And our hope is to be able to bring more information to all of you and have this exchange in various modalities over the course of the coming weeks and perhaps months, but know that UCLA is the resource that you can go to for answers, and that you can be an avid partner with each of us in spreading what UCLA is doing to respond to this pandemic. So thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.